I read your report, the article, and it is rather gloomy. Do you think that the situation with ISIS affecting Afghanistan and Central Asia is that bad?
I think specifically speaking to ISIS, the jury is still out. There is a little bit of difficulty right now discerning just what level ISIS has penetrated Afghanistan. Specifically, the northern provinces of Afghanistan have seen a significant degradation in security in recent months, and that can be attributable to a number of factors, not the least of which is an indigenous insurgency that has racked the country for the past 15 years. The contributions of ISIS to that, I think, are at this point, at the very least, are very difficult to assess. ISIS seems to be participating more in some instability in Nangarhar province, which is in the east, just south of Kunar, where a large amount of the fighting over the last 15 years has taken place. The impact for Central Asia is probably, at this point, it's difficult to assess as well, but the overall instability in Afghanistan does possess, or present rather, a significant threat to the regional stability in Central Asia. The most obvious of which are Tajikistan, which has recently banned foreign tourism from Gorno-Badakhshan, or autonomous region, as well as some skirmishes which have taken place in Turkmenistan between the Turkmen security forces and some militia that have sort of passed over the border into Turkmenistan from time to time from Afghanistan.
So if, in case the conflict spills over to Central Asia, which of the Central Asian states do you think is the weakest link? I mean, Tajikistan has Russian base, Uzbekistan has the strongest army, but overall, which one of the is the weakest links to your mind?
I think you make some good points with regard to both Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. Turkmenistan obviously has a very weak military. They're very susceptible to any sort of upheaval or instability. Uzbekistan's national security forces are probably the best of the lot. They have recently had some skirmishes with other states as well. The ethnic violence that has sort of permeated the region over the last decade has often involved Uzbek security forces. I think Tajikistan is likely to be the most susceptible to the instability spilling over from Afghanistan. In recent months, CSTO exercises have taken place along the border region of the Panj River, and I think that's a reflection of both Russia's concern over the rising instability in northern Afghanistan, as well as the Tajik government's willingness to participate in, even beyond CSTO exercises, the Tajik government's willingness to cooperate with Russia on a number of security matters, to include additional materiel from the Russian military inside Tajikistan and the stationing of Russian troops, which obviously has gone on for quite a while, but Russia has increased its presence along the border region. I think this is all a reflection of the susceptibility of the Tajiks.
Recently, a lot of groups have pledged allegiance to ISIS, Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, Boko Haram. Why do you think the Taliban has not followed their path and has chosen to fight ISIS?
That's a very interesting question. I think the initial assessments of a lot of the unwillingness of Taliban to participate in the sort of rise of ISIS across several countries, obviously Syria and Iraq, I think the Taliban are more so than the other states in Central Asia are more an indigenous insurgency. In many respects, they can be considered a Pashtun nationalist movement among many of their followers. If the rise of ISIS in other states is to be used as sort of a backdrop for understanding its rise in Afghanistan, the concern obviously for the Taliban is an external force controlling or commanding those forces inside Afghanistan. The Taliban still have as their goal, the unseating of the Kabul government, which they deride as illegitimate, and as propped up by external forces, you know, basically NATO and ISAF. And I think that speaks to the independence of the Taliban movement from the more international forces of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and that while they maintain a working relationship with groups such as the IMU or Al-Qaeda or even TTP in Pakistan, oftentimes their goals diverge. And though ISIS may have more internationalist goals of establishing a wider caliphate across the region, the Taliban, for the most part, still mainly focus on either their local areas or more generally in Afghanistan.
Can an ISIS threat be a major factor in the Taliban's decision to start talks with the Afghan government?
Yes, that's also an interesting question. I was having a discussion yesterday with a member of a force in the region, and he noted the possibility that the rise of ISIS could be used by the Taliban as leverage in the negotiations with the Kabul government. And it's very timely that ISIS has begun its campaign in Afghanistan at a time when the Taliban and other insurgent groups have surged, specifically in the north and in the east. And certainly if ISIS pressures the government with an additional prong of attacks, a different set of problems and security threats, it could motivate the government to concessions with the Taliban simply to avoid an escalation in the campaign in the war between the Taliban and the government. If that leverage is something that is an actual concept in this discussion, I think the Taliban could certainly use it as leverage insofar as the government would want to wean off of the battlefield as many of those Taliban forces as they possibly could to avoid a situation where the government was at an even more significant disadvantage in the overall fight against the insurgency.
How do you rate the readiness of the Afghan army? I mean, in case ISIS starts an offensive in Afghanistan, because we see that the Iraqi army is not a match to ISIS.
That's an excellent question. Over the past 15 years, oftentimes soldiers and other service personnel which have partnered with the Afghan National Army have often been frustrated by the lack of what they see as efficiency and capability. However, there has been a significant improvement in those forces over 15 years. The motivations, the pay, the overall investment of the average Afghan soldier into his job in defending the country, the so-called professionalizing of the force. I think comparatively speaking, the comparison between the Iraqi military and the Afghan military is a good one. And in my opinion, in my view, Afghan forces are significantly more capable and motivated at this point to battle their insurgency as well as any potential threat from ISIS. The reason I say that is because if you look at recent months in Afghanistan, specifically in places such as Kunduz, Baghlan, Badakhshan, and other areas of the northern provinces, specifically around the border regions with those Central Asian states, the Afghan army has taken significant casualties. However, they haven't failed to return to the battlefield. They've elicited quite a bit of attrition from those insurgent forces. The numbers that I've seen are daily in the dozens of insurgents killed. And whether or not those numbers are accurate, what that portrays, in my view, is the fight is very difficult. But the fact that the Afghan National Security Forces more generally, or the Afghan army specifically, continues to return to the fight and absorb those casualties and return fire is a big part of a reflection of an improvement in the Afghan army. And in that respect, I'm hopeful that the Afghan National Army has become a fighting force that's capable of both defending the borders, protecting the government, and ensuring its own legitimacy among the people that it frankly has to defend.
But could it be that because there are still sizable international force on the ground in Afghanistan and in Iraq there is none?
That certainly could be a factor. The support that the Afghan forces receive on a daily basis from international forces is probably at this point a little bit more significant than that would be provided to forces, say, fighting in Anbar province in Iraq. Although I sort of blanch at the idea that that's an easy assessment to make. The Iraqi forces have been on the receiving end of significant amounts of support from the international community most recently, an escalation in airstrikes targeting ISIS both inside Syria and inside Iraq. In that respect, I think a comparison between the Iraqi army and the Afghan army is still valid, but I would personally assess that the Afghan army has demonstrated better capability and, more importantly, from a soldier's perspective, a willingness to fight and return to the battlefield after absorbing those casualties and understanding that the threat from the insurgent forces is sufficient that they haven't so-called run away from the fight, as we've seen in Iraq.
How would you comment on Obama saying that it will be easier to fight ISIS without Assad in power?
I think the issue of Assad's power and his control over Syria, although it's waning, is an important one. As we've seen in Iraq in 2003 and in Libya in 2011, the removal of the central government in a lot of these states, which are bound by very, very weak ties between these different ethnic groups and these different sub-religious sects, it's a very difficult proposition to remove a very strong, historically centralized government structure such as the one in Damascus. Obviously, Bashar al-Assad has followed his father, Hafez, in being a very strong, for lack of a better term, a strong man in that country for decades. I disagree that it would be easier to fight ISIS as an entity with the removal of Assad, simply because if you remove Assad, you could be weakening the Syrian army and therefore removing a capability or a tool in your belt with which to battle ISIS.
Which means the United States is still not learning its past mistakes, right? Because they keep repeating that all the conflicts like Libya, Syria, Iraq are not related.
That is definitely a good point. There is a certain section of policymakers and strategists which seek to use regime change as the main impetus or the main driver of U.S. policy in the region. And personally speaking, I'm very much opposed to using regime change insofar as I think it causes a power vacuum that isn't so easily filled with a force that can control threats that may emanate from the indigenous population. We've seen that in Iraq, and we've seen it in Libya, and we're seeing it now in Syria. So insofar as regime change policy, I think a removal of a strong regime, certainly one as strong historically as the Assad regime, could do damage for the ability of international forces to combat the rising threat of ISIS, if only because the momentum and the inertia gained by a group like ISIS with the removal of the central government would be in some ways insurmountable. They would definitely be the momentum that they would gain from a so-called victory and removing a central government could very well catalyze similar situations in places such as Turkmenistan, which is, by and large, their military has been racked by drug use. It's a very weak military, and given the energy resources in the country and its central importance to countries such as China and Russia and other regional actors, it could be detrimental to regional security to have another regime, another central regime removed with no real plan as to how to fill that vacuum with a structure that has both the legitimacy from the people and the legitimacy to govern them. And if the people don't buy into the government, if they see it as effectively imposed or implemented by a foreign or external actor, it's not going to do much good for the security forces who have to remain loyal to that regime and combat the enemies, even if they're coming from inside the country.
You write that the environment in Central Asia is ripe for ISIS to come in and find a support base. But as you can see, there are other people joining the group. I mean, from the West, people well-established, you know, not poor, from democratic countries.
I think that insofar as the ground at this point is ripe for a further radicalization of the population. And I should probably couch my remarks by saying that I think it's important to note that the stronger that the regimes crack down on issues such as human rights, political dissent, democratic governance, representative governance, I think it's a situation where you create a culture which opens up the population to further radicalization. The states of Central Asia, by and large, are a very young population. Those regimes have been in power for the most part since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. In recent months, we've seen the assassination of political dissent leaders from Tajikistan and Turkey. We've seen the Uzbek security services involved in or suspected to be involved in similar actions. And I think that the longer that those regimes practice such heavy-handed tactics against political dissent, it can only strengthen groups like ISIS.
What attracts people in ISIS? Financial motivation?
Certainly with the Central Asian component of the recruitment, you have quite a few Uzbeks which are fighting in Syria, which are not necessarily always motivated by Islamist ideology. Insofar as they are all Muslim fighters, that is always a baseline for the purpose of someone going to Syria and fight, of course. But I think you have varying levels of Islamist motivation. And again, returning to the issue of Uzbeks specifically fighting in Syria, there's some good studies which indicate that many of them were just seeking to battle a regime in Damascus, which they saw as illegitimate and repressive of the Syrian people and repressive of Muslims. It wasn't so much that they were looking to establish a caliphate that was the original motivating factor in their recruitment, so much as it was the idea that they would be involved in a fight that would be righteous, so to speak. And your mentioning of the financial aspect of the recruitment is also an important one. You know, if ISIS is able to provide funding for fighters and pay them well, it obviously is a beneficial motivator in escalating the numbers in their ranks. I think at this point also that the jury is out on many groups' affiliation with ISIS, so to speak. ISIS certainly has some sort of centralized structure, but it seems as though they are the brand of the moment, which, at least in Afghanistan historically, many of the localized fighters have worn the so-called T-shirt of the most financially beneficial group, whether it was Al-Qaeda or whether it was Hezbi Islami Gulbuddin, or whoever it was that could provide the greatest financing. And at the moment, it seems that ISIS, specifically through their gains in Iraq, has gained some sort of momentum as far as establishing a ready-made flow of financing for their operations. So that's definitely a factor.